Are you ready to cheat on your wife? No, I'm not talking about that kind of cheating. I'm talking about gaining an unfair advantage on how to understand your wife better, love her deeper, avoid unnecessary arguments, and even have more sex with her. That's right. Based on the success of our Marriage Secrets for Men boot camps, we're finally sharing the Marriage Cheat Sheet for Men with the public. This is the quick reference must-have go-to guide for husbands and wannabe husbands that can help stack the odds in your favor. The Bible tells us to live with our wives in an understanding way. Well, the Marriage Cheat Sheet for Men is your shortcut to doing that. So you'll learn 4 questions you can ask your wife in every argument to avoid future arguments. You'll learn the 45 questions you can ask her to learn and master her heart. 50 ways to love your wife better. 6 things you can say to her to manage her response before you damage her emotions. 10 things you can do right now that will lead to more sex. 8 ways to get her to stop ignoring you. Even 49 ways to have more meaningful conversations with your wife, and much, much more. See, this is the manual every divorced man wishes he had before he got married. Well, at least I did. And I'm so God confident that the Marriage Cheat Sheet will become one of the most valuable referred to resources in your marriage library, that if you don't think so, just send it back for a full refund. Trust me, next to our Marriage Secrets for Men bootcamp, this will be the 2nd best investment you will ever make in your marriage. Now, to get your copy of the Marriage Cheat Sheet for Men on sale for a limited time only, just go to realmenconnect.com and click on the store button. That's realmenconnect.com.
Welcome to Real Men Connect. Are you ready to be the extraordinary man, husband, father, and leader God called and created you to be? Then get ready to receive wisdom and guidance from some of the country's most respected men of faith as you learn everything you need to know to go from good man to great man, God's way. No judgment, no shame. Just real men with real challenges seeking real change. All for God's glory.
Hello, mighty men of God, and welcome to the Real Men Connect podcast, where we help good men become great men God's way. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Martin, and every week we interview some of the nation's most respected and accomplished men of faith to find out what it really takes to become the kind of husband, father, and spiritual leader God called and created us to be. Each interview session is packed with practical, proven biblical principles you can immediately apply in your relationships, on your job, and in your community. Today we have with us Edwin Leahy, or Father Ed as he prefers to be called, who is the headmaster of the St. Benedict's Preparatory School for Boys in Newark, New Jersey. Father Ed graduated from St. Benedict's Prep himself back in 1963. He has a BA in philosophy from Seton Hall University and a master's in divinity from Woodstock College in New York. An ordained priest, Father Ed began his work at St. Benedict's Prep in 1967, teaching biology and religion and assisting with the wrestling and football teams. Now, I first heard about Father Ed after watching a story about St. Benedict's Prep on 60 Minutes on CBS earlier this year. I think it was back in the spring. And even though I'm an educator myself, I've worked with students and trained teachers at hundreds of school districts across this country, what amazed me the most about St. Benedict Prep's wasn't just the fact that they were a successful school, nearly graduating 100% of their students who go on to college, but they served a high-risk population of all boys from largely low-income families, and yet these young men seem to share a brotherhood and a bond that I've never seen before, except in gangs. Now, this surprised me because I grew up in the inner-city ghettos of Miami, Florida, and I could have never imagined going to a school like St. Benedict Prep. But I wish I had. So I wanted to bring Father Ed on the show to share his story, talk about his school, the development of young men, and why they've been so successful. So to say that I'm excited about this interview is an understatement. So that being said, welcome Father Ed to the Real Men Connect podcast, and thanks for agreeing to be on the show.
Dr. Joe, I'm happy to be on the show. I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk to you and to give my experience, at least that may be able to be helpful to a lot of other men.
Well, Father Ed, I know you're going to be helpful because I know my heart and my passion for education. And most people know me now from this podcast knowing that I have a heart for men, but it started out in education and I still have a heart for education and I still work in the field of education. And even though we've had a lot of shows, very rarely do I get to bring on someone who has a passion for education, but has a love for God as well. And there's a lot of stuff I want to jump into, but before we get started, Pastor Ed, what we always try to do is we ask men to share with us their favorite Bible verse, something out of the Word of God that kind of inspires them and gets them going. Do you have a favorite Bible verse? And if so, what is it and why is it inspirational to you?
I actually have a couple, but one that that is especially important to me is the story of the Transfiguration. When the disciples were having a hard time hearing the Lord when he began to speak about the necessity of the Son of Man going to Jerusalem, there being suffer and to die, but be raised on the third day, they struggled with that, like all of us do. And the Lord, in his own way, invited his closest friends, Peter, James, and John, to go up on the mountain, and there gave him a glimpse of what was possible. Right? Gave him a glimpse of glory, of himself glorified, that would help to carry them through the trials and the tribulations of life. It strikes me their reaction is the same as mine frequently. That Peter saw what was going on. He said, "It's good for us to be here. Let's just stay here. Let's not go anywhere else. Let's just stay here." And kind of telescoping the story for you, you know it as well as I do that they didn't stay there. The Lord led them back down the mountain, and their first encounter going back down the mountain was a father. Who's was described in some translations of the scriptures as his son was a lunatic, and used to throw himself in fire and probably an epileptic. Back then they didn't know it, and so this the Lord leading the disciples from this vision of glory back down into the valley of human suffering. And I think that's for me what our life is as Christians is supposed to be. That you spend time going aside with the Lord in prayer, but always for a purpose, always to go back, to be of service, and especially service to those who don't know where else to turn frequently. So that's that story. When in my difficult moments, which are frequent, is a favorite. I like to go back to it to remind myself of the need for prayer constantly in my own life, but then to be also alert for the valley of human suffering and to be alert for those who are in need.
You know, and I agree with you, Father Ed, because, you know, we call those mountaintop experiences, but at the same time, we weren't meant to stay on top of the mountain. We have to go back down to the valley and do God's work. And so I love your angle and your perspective on that. Now, before we get into talking about the school, I'm so impressed with what St. Benedict is doing. But, you know, I mentioned in your bio when introducing you that you were a student at St. Benedict Prep back in 1963, but it was a totally different type of school then than it is now. Tell me a little bit about your childhood and your journey to that school when it was predominantly white school.
Sure. My childhood was I was raised in suburban New Jersey, about 12 miles south of Newark. And raised by a mom and a dad and with my two sisters and a brother, all of whom are younger than I. I'm the oldest of four. The two girls are between my brother and I. In fact, my brother teaches and is our athletic director here at school right now, having gone here himself to school. And so it was a school of 800 students, virtually all white, a handful of kids of color. All of those kids were African Americans. I grew up looking young and looking younger than I really was, right? And so I had this experience in when I was finished my senior year in high school here. I had graduated. My father got me a job with the operating engineers. He was an engineer, construction worker. And I would go out on these union jobs, 17 years old, looking like I was 12. And absolutely no one paid any attention to me. In fact, they made it worse, right? They'd see me coming and they'd go like, who is this kid connected to and all that. Until one job I went on, the only person that entire summer took any interest in me and to teach me anything and show me the ins and outs of machinery and all that was an African-American. And you have to remember, this is 1963, prior to the March on Washington, prior to the church episode of the explosion of the church in later that same year. So it was a very different world for people of color. Huh? And for this guy to take an interest in me was like stunning to me. I never forgot that. I remember going home and talking to my dad He said, I've always told you to judge people and accept people as they are and as they come to you, which is exactly the way the Lord accepts us. Huh? The Lord loves us as we are, which is also stunning and shocking because I know how I am. Right. And in spite of how I am, the Lord still loves me. It's amazing to me. Every day I say, wow, that's something. The Lord is amazing. So that was my early life. And I wanted to enter the monastery. I knew that when I was young, I was always surrounded by priests who would stop by the house. I lived only a block from the house, from the church. And I was in the church all the time because anytime anybody at the church needed anything, my parents would chase me down because it was only a block away. And that was my early life through teenage years. And then I entered the monastery and was raised a second time, so to speak, Joe, because I was then raised by the African-American community in Newark. And which was one Sunday, I was a typical white priest ministering in an African-American church. And the way God works, I had listened for years to a couple of local pastors preach on Sunday mornings. And one Sunday I was preaching in this church like any normal white priest trained at the period of time when I was trained. Preaching that way, and one Sunday morning, somebody shouted, and I found myself saying more. You know what I mean? You know how that works. And they kept talking to me as I was preaching, and little by little, the community in that church taught me how I could be of service to them, and I learned a lot from that, as well as from the parents here when we first tried to get the school going again. It was never our intention to reopen St. Benedict's Prep after it closed in 1972. We never wanted to reopen St. Benedict's Prep. And we had another idea. We got it going. And one night at a parents' meeting, one of the parents said to me, Carl, I remember his name, Carl Lamb was his name. And he said, Father Man, I have a question. How come it was good enough to be St. Benedict's Prep when it was all of you? And now that it's all of us, it can't be St. Benedict's Prep anymore. So I have, wherever over the last 43 years, whenever I get an opportunity to talk about the reopening of the school, it was never me or the monks who reopened the school. It was Carl Lamb who reopened St. Benedict's Prep. We had another view of it, right? So I was raised again then by the parents of the kids that were coming to us, and they taught me and us how we could be of service to them. So we learned early, and I learned, as they say in self-help groups, to take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth, you know, to just shut up and listen. And people would teach us how we could help rather than us. At that time, our community, it's not that way now, but our monastic community was all white. Rather than us creating this white overlay on the top of the African-American community, right? So by God's grace, we had a lot of good people around us very early in this process that helped me to be raised a second time by the community of color here in Newark.
Father Ed, you mentioned that how you graduated from the school, but then you went into the monastery. But there's a different leap going from the monastery than going into school to teach, to be a teacher. What motivated you, inspired you to go to St. Benedict Prep as a teacher? Because they said that you were teaching biology and religion, and you were also working with some of the athletic teams. What got you into working and giving your time back to the school again?
So my father sent me here to school. I didn't know where it was. I told him, I said, I don't know where the school is. He said, well, you get off the train in Newark and you look for it. And which I did, and I found it, right? But my father had these interesting knacks of creating confidence in me. Even though I was the oldest child and wasn't necessarily full of confidence, you know what I mean? I had to learn it. I remember the day I got my driver's license. My mother, who was an only child, she had taken me to get the test. I came back to the house, and I wanted to return here to Newark to go to swimming practice. And my mother was apoplectic. She said, oh, you can't drive back there. You just got your license. So she called my father at work, which was a no-no, but she did it anyway. And he said, did he get his license? And my mother said, yes. He said, well, the state of New Jersey says he can drive. Who are you to say he can't? Which is another example of him creating confidence in me, right? So he sent me here to school. I went to school. And then the monastery runs the school.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. When I entered the monastery here, our principal work is St. Benedict's prep. Okay. So that, so I began teaching then. And then when it closed in 72, I was here trying to help figure out what we were going to do. And I knew nothing about running a school. But everybody kind of said, well, you do it. And I just worked on trying to help put it together with a lot of, you know, if you're a leader, you know this. I mean, you don't have to be the smartest guy in the group. You just have to be smart enough to get a lot of smart people around you. And I was able to have some really, really bright people around me who helped put this thing together. So the monastery, the school is a monastery's principal work.
But Father, tell me why you said the school closed down in 1972. What brought that on that they felt we had to just shut this down?
Racism.
Really?
Racism. Yeah, absolutely.
Go a little bit deeper into that for me. What happened?
As the school became in the late 60s, right, the riots in Newark, the rebellion, the uprising, history has characterized it differently at different times. That happened right in front of us in 1967 on the street that we're on. And so as a result of that, numbers in the school began to dwindle some. But even in the monastery, which, as I say, was all white, people began to say, oh, the standards are dropping. Now, I know what the standards were when I was a kid here. I know who was here and how some of the guys got here. And they got here because they were in trouble somewhere else. And somebody said, take them to the school. So the standards thing was a big illusion that was supposed to, in my opinion, camouflage the real issue, which was racism that we all suffer with, right? That all white people suffer with. They'll try to tell you they don't. Oh, yeah, I'm not a racist, but it's in all of us, especially older ones of us who are raised in a certain way. So that's what, in my opinion, caused the demise, which is a little disturbing, given it was a group of people trying to live the Christian life.
Right.
So to be talking about even in the monastery, this issue of race, which is America's original sin, that is a little disturbing. So that was, in my opinion, that was the reason for it.
Now, Father Ed, now you were only 27 at the time, and I'm not. This is no knock against you personally, but what made them believe? What made the community think that you could reopen the school and turn it around? Because you said Carl Land was kind of responsible for that. But what gave them confidence in you? Because I'm thinking 27 years old, that's pretty young. What made them think you could be the catalyst for the turnaround?
That's a good question. The Holy Spirit, I think, is the only way to explain that, Joe. There is no other reason why anybody would have thought that me at that age would be able to do this, except there were not many other options, right? We had nothing. We had no school. And then to live our life of... as a monk, we pray five times a day together. We eat meals together. We recreate together. So if you don't have a common work holding you together, it's difficult to live the life, you see. So we knew we needed to try to do something together. And what we were all best equipped to do was to run a school, since we had run one a year before when it closed. And what the city desperately needed was a school. But the question was, do we try to shape a school and then pick somebody to run it, or do we get somebody to run it and have that person help to shape it? And eventually they just landed on the fact that, well, let's pick somebody. And I wound up being the only guy crazy enough to do it, I guess is the way to say it. Or what I was able to do, and maybe that's what people saw, was I could create enthusiasm and create energy. Once I created that, I had no idea what to do. That's why I had to have these smart guys around me to put some things together. But I could get people excited and say, let's go. Follow me. We're going to make this. This is going to work. And they would do it. But why I have that gift, I have no idea. The Lord gave it to me. I didn't do anything to get it.
Well, because, I mean, that would have scared me to death at the age of 27.
Well, but at 27, well, we were talking earlier. I mean, somehow at 28, you had a PhD.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that must have somehow scared you. That, given your experience, you right. didn't see a lot of PhDs in the projects in Miami.
Right.
So how did you get to be able to get a PhD at 28 years old?
Yeah,
the Lord Spirit. Does things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. God is in our history, right? And that's important to what the insight of the Jews in the Hebrew scriptures was, God is a God of history. He's a God of our own personal history as well. And we don't realize a lot of stuff until we look back and we say, how the heck did I ever do that? Mm-hmm. And you have to say, well, it wasn't me. It was the Lord working through me that allowed that to happen.
Right, right. All right, well, let's get into the school now. So what do you think, and I know this is a broad question, but what do you think were some of the keys or key to the school's turnaround? I know it didn't happen overnight, but what were some of the key elements?
Well, the key elements from the very, very beginning were number one, don't do for kids what kids can do for themselves. So what, and I think early on, I felt that the, especially, remember, we're a single sex school, right? We're just young men. And young men of color have, and back then, when we started this in 1973, young men of color have no voice in this country. And it's somewhat better now, but still problematical. I mean, because I think a lot of people, as we will, we'll see where we go going forward here with the challenges that we have as a country. But even, I think a lot of people of, a lot of white people especially felt, oh, well, we're in great shape. Now we elected an African-American president, right? Which is fool's gold as far as I believe. I mean, race is still our biggest problem. Not to do anything for kids that they can do for themselves, and to help to create situations where young men of color had a voice. In other words, they could make arguments, they could get in verbal fights and be fought with. And you know what I mean? And discover they can win the argument. So the trick for us as adults still is today is if you're going to pick a fight, pick one that you want to lose so that the kids can feel, wow, people do listen to me. I can make arguments. I can make points. I can affect change. So that I think they were the principles from the very, very beginning that still persist today. We've discovered other things as we've gone along. That are now kind of bedrock things for us in terms of running it, but that it wasn't that way in the very, very beginning.
Now, you know, we know that an organization's mission drives its vision. And I see that St. Benedict's mission is to prepare young men to fulfill their potential as emotionally mature, morally responsible, and well-educated young men. Has that always been the mission? And if not, how did you guys come up with that being the bedrock or the foundation and say, this is what we're going to build this on?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was from the beginning, I think we always had a sense of that. From the very beginning, we were able to create a system that allowed students to develop leadership skills. But then we began to discover that a lot of the difficulties that young men in our urban centers have, especially young men of color, are tremendous issues of their heart. So if you don't tend to their heart, you make the task way more difficult for them in learning and advancing academically. So we learned that. We didn't realize that in the beginning. What we knew in the beginning is we wanted kids to have control of the school, to run the school, and to learn to be leaders. We learned afterwards that in order for that to happen, you have got to tend to their heart. You just can't pay attention to their head. And with the academic endeavor, you had to pay attention to their heart as well. So what's grown over in our more recent history, the last 25 years, has been a significant component of the school is counseling, both self-help groups that kids run themselves, and then one-to-one face-to-face talk therapy for kids, because the issue of anger, my guess is you've realized this in a lot of ways from your own experience in life, of absent fathers or the violence that goes on around you in life, sometimes in the building you live in and sometimes in the house that you live in or the apartment that you live in, causes tremendous upset and anger in young men. And if you don't attend to it, little by little, it destroys it.
Now, so you mentioned about, as far as the emotionally mature, you kind of broke that down for us, and that's good. of understanding that these boys do come with some heart issues that need to be addressed. And there's a bunch of them, and you touched on some of them. Now, when in your mission, when it's morally responsible, what does that mean to you at St. Benedict as far as raising morally responsible young men?
Yeah, men. Well, I mean, let me answer that question this way. People ask me all the time, what's the most satisfying part of the responsibility that I have, being the head of the school? And that's an easy one for me to answer, Joe, because the most satisfying thing for me is not whether guys went to Harvard or whether they went to Yale or to Stanford or Morehouse or wherever. Most satisfying thing for me is when our guys can come back and introduce me to their kids, because many of them were not able to be introduced to me when they were kids by their fathers, because their fathers weren't present. So when they can come back and introduce me to their kids, I know that they're in their kids' life and in their, that for me is the most satisfying thing, because that's the way that the issues of the heart are much better dealt with by your father and by your mother rather than by your school. The school's supposed to support your father and mother, right? But if your dad's not there to do it, it becomes a big problem. So when our guys are doing that, it's, for me, it's special. So, if that answers your question relative to the moral, part of what we're trying to do with guys, and then try to, which is very difficult with teenagers, as you know, to create young men of faith, right? And we've got, interestingly, that's why I think people get attracted to this place, because we're by far Christian in the school, the adults as well as the kids. But we have a significant part of the population that are Muslim. We've got a couple of kids that have come from different parts of Asia that are Hindu. So that there's, in most parts of the world where we're killing each other over so-called religion, here, these kids are a great sign of hope. They are to me, and I believe they are to other people that in the city, to see kids with these backgrounds and these different religious approaches to the mystery of God, all being recreating together, studying together, arguing together in faith, right? So that for me, it's an encouragement.
You know, and Father Ed, I don't want to get off on a tangent because I got to address that. How are you able to navigate that as a school when it comes to that? Obviously, you have a Christian-based focus, but not everyone is of the same faith. And yet, and I know this because I know a little bit more background than our listeners know about your school. I tell you what really attracted me to want to do this interview with you was the brotherhood that those kids displayed. Forget, and you know, I loved, you know, you had the vision and the mission of emotionally mature, morally responsible, and well-educated young men. But what I wish I could get the listeners to go find out about this school is that their closeness and their brotherhood, and how have you been able to overcome the faith barrier? You know, because typically that what divides us in the public school system, in our society, but yet you guys have seemed to overcome that. What do you think has been the key to that?
So I think there's several possible ways to answer that, and you can stop me whenever you want. Number one is the fact that we are Christian makes it incumbent on us to love the other the way the other is, because that's the way that what the Lord does for us. The Lord went all the way to the cross in silence, accepting an unjust death out of love for me and for you and for the world. And then he said, love one another as I have loved you. Well, which means we have to be willing to accept injustice in the face of difficult situations to love the other. So lots of people say, well, how can you shouldn't have people that are not Christian in a Christian school? No, we do it. We're the Christians. That's why we do it.
Right. Right.
So it's not the people who are coming to you that have to be Christian. The Christians who are doing it have to be Christian and accept people. So that's number one.
I love that.
Number two, it's been a big problem in the Catholic Church, by the way. Lots of Catholics say, oh, you shouldn't have those kids in the school because they're not Catholic.
Wow.
No, wait a minute. We have them in the school because we're Catholic, not mm-hmm. because they're Catholic. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's very important. The second part of it is we do, on a practical side, we do everything together. So we meet every single day. What you saw in 60 Minutes that Scott Pelley and those people captured was an everyday occurrence, this morning meeting. So we don't make any announcements through loudspeakers. There's no voices coming through the walls or anything. It's we do everything face to face. So if there's a problem, we solve it together as well, which can be very difficult for lots of adults, because if you're a mother or a father come to pick your son up at 3:30 in the afternoon at the end of school, and we had a particular problem that the senior who runs the school decides, I want everybody back after school. All he has to do is say, I want everybody back at this convocation after school. And there'll be 600 people in the gym waiting for him.
Wow.
Well, if you're the parent outside waiting to pick up your son, your whole day could get turned upside down, because we may be in a meeting for 40 minutes trying to solve a problem.
Wow.
So it kind of bonds guys together, but in the everyday of how you address issues, how you address each other's sufferings, how you address problems. And the motto that gets pushed everywhere, it's written on walls, we talk about it all the time, is whatever hurts my brother hurts me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the everyday part. And now when they come to us, there are two bookend experiences that they have in ninth grade that begins that process of melting guys together. And one is what we call the freshman overnight. They come and they stay overnight and sleep on the gym floor together. They don't know each other when they first walk through the doors. And we create pressure on them with older guys. It's similar to what the Marine Corps does. By the end of that first week, you can't wear, when you come to us, Joe, you can't wear any of our stuff. You can't wear our school colors. You can't wear our name on anything. And you have to earn it. Well, the way you earn it, if you have, you're put into a group of eight students. So there's about 16 or 18 groups of eight. Well, in order to get the opportunity, the privilege of wearing our name, wearing our colors, being part of us, you earn it by passing this oral test.
Mm-hmm.
And if eight guys take the test and seven guys pass and one guy fails, everybody fails.
Wow.
So the other guys have to work hard to get the weakest guy through. Nobody gets left behind.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Well, that melts guys together. So by the end of the first week, guys who had no clue who each other were when they came 5 days earlier can name virtually everybody in the class in 1 week.
Wow.
That's the beginning of this whole ninth grade year, which ends with what you saw in 60 Minutes, which was the 55-mile hike on the Appalachian Trail, the Backpack Project.
Mm-hmm.
Which is all led by kids and creates teamwork, creates community, creates bonding. So we work real hard at having guys be responsible for each other. And the thing works. It's amazing. The kids run it. Kids run it every day. The kids run the school. I get in arguments with them because of decisions that they make. And other adults will get in arguments with them. They'll change the school schedule. They can make any decision they want, the leadership of the school, any decision they want. The essential rule is, if you're going to make one without adult advice, you had better be right, because no parent is going to come after the 18-year-old senior group leader. They're going to come after me.
If
you're going to put me out there exposed, so to speak, without having a chance to participate in the decision, you had better knock it over the fence, because I'm going to get all the headaches, not you. And the kids do a great job. When there's mistakes and failures, you debrief them. That kids are going to learn a lot from that and move forward. But it gives the kids a sense of ownership and partnership with each other that I think is the answer to your question of how you build this sense of community. Because what's been fractured by drugs, by weapons, and by everything else in our cities is the sense of community.
Wow. I tell you, this is really, really good. I mean, it makes perfect sense what you're describing here. I run a small men's disciple making group, and our purpose is we want to not only get equipped, but to go out and equip others. And we were discussing about what's necessary in boys and what's necessary in girls, and trying to kind of overgeneralize it, but you seem to have a great grasp on this. We said that what girls need is to feel a sense of security and affirmed by their fathers, that they're beautiful, they're loved, that they're safe around their dad. But we said what young men need is a sense of confidence, that they're affirmed. And you mentioned earlier that you're trying to teach them to be leaders. Everything it seems that you're doing at the school, you guys are doing, is to build leaders. And you can only do that by giving them responsibility and equipping them. And even though you're allowing them to make all these decisions, you guys are staying saying, we trust you. You're basically saying, we trust you. And I'm sure when they do knock it out the park, you guys are affirming them and saying, we knew you could do this. You're really growing and teaching men to be men.
Correct. That's the aim of, I think, of the whole thing, to be men of faith, number one. And to be able to demonstrate love for the other. I think that's what it's all about. And that's what we suffer most in this country from right now, the lack of all that. Like we create divisions. It's sad. So I think that for me, and remember the kids are disciples as well, right? So I mean they're announcing to the adults. It's not just a one-way street where the adults are doing all this teaching. It's not that at all. The kids are demonstrating to us a whole lot of things and pointing out things, weaknesses in us. I just had a teacher this morning at our morning meeting. We read from the scriptures every morning, and he began talking because it was the gospel was the Lord chasing the money changers out of the temple. And the Lord demonstrating anger. So this teacher, who is a medical doctor also, but doesn't practice medicine, he teaches chemistry, began talking about anger and the challenges that he's had in his own life with anger. And this is in front of 550 students and probably 45 faculty members. That he's doing this in public, it becomes kind of a communal demonstration of the challenges that we live with individually in life. But lots of people go through life, don't admit those, right? They hide them. And you're only as sick as your secrets. So if you're keeping secrets, it causes problems. So that's the effect of this, creating a sense of community. People also are willing to make themselves vulnerable to one another.
No, Father Ed, I know this may not even be a fair question, and I hate to put you on the spot like this, and it's kind of like a sidebar. This is not a question I planned to ask. But because I work with so many school districts across the country, in your humble opinion, do you think the public school system could pull off anything like what you guys are doing at St. Benedict's?
That's a great question. We've been asked that so many times since 60 Minutes. People have called us from all over the country. Mm-hmm. I think there are parts of it that they could pull off. Yes. Could they replicate this? Difficult, because remember, as I said earlier in our conversation, that I live in a monastery, and there's 14 of us living in the monastery, which is right here on the school is on the grounds of the monastery. Therefore, mm-hmm. it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
So that the place is like a diner; it never closes. And our guys know that, right? So there, you could go into our gym at 10 o'clock at night and find a bunch of lawyers and bankers. Who are our alumni who got together on Thursday night to play basketball. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't ask anybody. They just came and walked into the gym and played, because I'll give you the best example of it. After 9/11 in 2001, we had to go to a whole different security system. And we created badges, and you had to check in at the front door and your name. And our alumni went out of their minds, Joe. They went crazy. What are you talking about? I have to wear a badge. I don't have to wear a badge at a place that I own. How could I? So we actually had to create a different shape badge for the alumni. They weren't ecstatic about it, but they're willing to put up with that, because there's a sense of ownership of the place that's difficult to create in a public school.
Right.
I think. But you have to have adults who see in my opinion, there's a difference between a job and a vocation. And you need to have people that are living and are accompanying these kids in our cities through this part of their life, you have to have people who see it as a vocation. Once you see it as a job, you should go find something else to do.
Right.
Because it requires loving the kids. Loving the kids. And it can't be a way simply of making money to support your own family. It does that, but it can't be simply that. And if you don't love the kids, if you're not invested in their success, kids pick up on that in an instant, and it won't work. So I think that can be done in a public school if you have the right leaders. If you have the right leaders, but to create this sense where it's always open, always available, that's really hard to do financially and every other way that we have built in because we live here. Kids in trouble, we have kids run away from home and they run here.
Right. Wow.
At 2 o'clock in the morning, you're trying to adjust this. Yeah, it happens all the time. We just had it happen a couple of weeks ago. Ran away from home, he comes here.
But you know, and I know that sounds bad to someone listening, but it actually is a good thing. The fact that they feel safe enough that's a place where I know I'm going to be loved. I'm going to feel secure. I often joke when I'm talking to kids across the country, when they hear about my background, they say, "Did you ever think about running away from home?" That's what they used to ask. And yep. I joke and say it tongue in cheek. I said, "Black kids don't run away from home." I said, "Cause nobody's going to take them in." Right. but I tell you, but listening to what you're telling me, I probably would have ran away to your school. It's not funny, but it's real. It's real. And Father Ed, I'll tell you one thing that's refreshing to hear, and I know this is probably going to sound sacrilegious to people out there who happen to be educators. You guys have built such a successful school, and I know that it's the grace of God that's allowed you to do it. But at the same time, even though it's in your mission statement to have well-educated young men, everything that you're talking about, it seems like education of the men is like a secondary thing, that happens as a result of meeting these other needs first. And typically when you're in talking to educators, that's not what they focus on. And I love the fact that you say, when people ask you all the time, what is it, you know, how does it make you feel? What makes you feel successful? You said that when a young man comes back to you who's graduated from your school and introduces you to his family, to his kids. I know why that gives you a lot of joy. I have a 20-year-old son, and I was we went to a conference, a mentoring conference, and someone came up to me and asked me, "How do you know when your son is being successful? Is it, you know, if he goes to the right school?" Because you guys have a lot of kids who go on to some great schools, some Ivy League schools, which people will tout that as your success. But you're like me, I'm thinking the same way you are. But when the man asked me, how do I determine my son's successful? I said, "I'll ask his wife." That's it. I said, "Yes." I said, "His wife will tell me whether or not he's been successful." I said, "Because what difference does it make if he succeeds in any arena, but he fails in his home?" And so to see that someone who's a headmaster in charge of this school has that focus, and then you empower your males to grow to be great men. I mean, it really is inspiring. But I want to ask you this question. And now you seem like I'm your friend now, but I'm going to ask you a tough question, okay?
That's fine.
Now, I noticed that we know now that most of the young men at your school, that I think is now up to 550 right. students that That's you guys cool. have, and they're mostly African-American heritage and Hispanic backgrounds. And I think that I read on your website that you guys have about a little bit over, what, about 58 faculty members or something like that?
Yes.
Now, when I taught as an educator full time, other than when I was a professor at a historically Black college, typically my colleagues were white and female. So now I can't tell from looking at your site the makeup of your faculty. What's the demographic makeup of the faculty at St. Benedict Prep?
Yeah, first of all, there are several women on our faculty. The faculty is overwhelmingly men. Overwhelmingly okay. men. Mm-hmm. But there are several women on the faculty. In fact, the dean of our faculty is a woman, because it's very easy for a single sex school of guys to turn into a locker room real quickly if you're not careful. So you need women who are willing or able to help guys to understand what's appropriate, what's allowable, what needs to happen in in the presence of women that you can be one way when you're hanging out with the guys, but you can't do that necessarily when you have women present. I think it's important for these kids to realize that.
Right.
So that's number one. There's a significant, the head of our art department, fine arts, is a woman. The dean of the faculty is a woman. Several math teachers are women. We're blessed because so many of our guys, our alums, I've been doing this so long that lots of our alums are back on the faculty. Mm. So many of them are guys of color, Latino guys and African Americans. The head of our college placement is one of our alums. He's a Haitian American. The dean of our 10th and 11th grade is an African American, also a Muslim. Great, one of our alums, the head of our freshman program, so he runs the overnight, runs the backpack project, is another alum who's African American. So there's a significant population. The head of our guidance and counseling center is a Latino, one of our alums. So we've been blessed by having talented people of color come back who are our own guys, mm-hmm. which has made it easier to recruit faculty, so to speak, I think. That makes it. Kids have got to see themselves
right
in the faculty. It's critical, and not just in token ways, in meaningful ways. They have to see themselves in the classroom. They also have to see themselves in the leadership mm-hmm. of the school mm-hmm. and the leadership of the school. So my job at this point in my life is to little by little make myself obsolete and have somebody else who's grown up in this thing be able to do it.
And Father Ed, you bring such a valuable point that I hope that those who are in education positions, as men out there who are listening to this podcast, hear what you just said. It's important for those children to see themselves in those roles. I never even thought about going into education until I was getting my master's degree. And I had African-American professors, the first African-American professor I ever had. And when I saw that, I don't know, something happened and stirred inside of me thinking, wow. The feeling of, I don't know, it was a sense of pride that I felt of, and he wasn't even that great of a teacher, but he was there. And yep. when I saw that, it just planted a seed that maybe I could give another kid that feeling that he could do it. Cause I never even thought about becoming a professor. And I ended up becoming the youngest professor in the state of Florida at the age of 24. But if it wasn't for seeing him in my classroom that day, I would have never even gave it a second thought. And so, but one of the challenges that I hear from administrators is that they can't recruit Latino faculty members and African-American faculty members. But you guys have overcome that because you said you were kind of recycling your alumni.
We're growing them. Yeah,
yeah, you're growing them. And so what would you suggest if you couldn't grow them? Do you have any ideas? Because you guys haven't had that problem. What would you suggest that administrators do to kind of recruit more faculty of color?
Well, I wonder where they look to recruit them. So, I mean, how many of those administrators have been to Morehouse, have been to Howard, have been mm-hmm. to historically black colleges that talk to them? How many have gone to some of these teacher placement schools? Notre Dame runs one. You have to have the desire, right? And it's got to be a burning desire that I need our kids to see themselves in the faculty.
Right.
Then you got to go anywhere you have to go to find them. It's much easier for us, though. So I don't want to make it sound simple. It's not. But you have to work at it. And even if you try to do it on a short term basis at first, just give me 3 years. Give me 5 years. I've told our guys that, give me 3 years or 5 years, there. Some of them are here for 15 years.
Wow.
Because once I get them to come, then the kids do the rest. Mm-hmm. So, but it's absolutely essential.
And what I'm hearing from you is that you just have to be very intentional about it. And I think that's some of the same advice I've given administrators, that when they say, but Joe, it's just too hard for us to recruit. I said, well, you're not trying hard enough. So you have to be intentional. I remember I was invited to speak and do some training at this school district in somewhere in Minnesota, where, I mean, it's remote. And mm-hmm. I was the only person of color in the city. And the superintendent, I asked him about the lack of diversity they had in their faculty. He says, Joe, we just can't recruit them. I said, that's not true. And he says, but we tried hard. I said, no, you're not. You're not trying hard enough. I said, how'd you find me? And he found me in Colorado at some other conference, and he brought me to his district. So they, you got to go, like you say, you got to know where to look and be intentional about it.
That's correct. And have a burning desire to make it happen.
Absolutely. But I think that we underestimate the power of that, but you guys obviously haven't had that problem. That I wish I can communicate this to teachers and to administrators. It just does something for a child's spirit when they can see themselves in a role. My son asked me when Obama got elected to office the first time. He said, "Dad, did you ever think you'd see African-American president?" And I said, "No." He said, "Now that you see one," he says, "what is that? How does it make you feel?" And I told my son that I should have dreamed bigger. That's because I said, as confident as I am, I never even thought and dreamed that I could be president of the United States until he did it.
That's correct.
And I say, I wish I can go back and dream bigger. But let me ask you this, because we're almost running short on time, Father Ed. But what were some of the biggest obstacles? Obviously, you guys are successful now, but what were some of the biggest obstacles your school had to overcome in achieving the success that you've achieved? What were some of your greatest challenges?
Well, always, continuously, even to this day, as I'm speaking to you, is the major challenge is a financial challenge, because we're providing this service to families who can't pay for the service, which is a bad business plan, right? But right. It's a really bad business plan. But I don't think the Lord, if the Lord sat down with a business plan, he wouldn't have done what he did.
Right.
So that for me is, I have to keep that in my mind, but it's not the thing that drives us every day, that somehow the Lord makes a way out of no way for us. And when we think we're hitting a dead end, an opening comes. So, but that's clearly a big challenge, the financial part of it. The other is to continue to try to develop ways of being able to affect numbers, volume, so to speak, of kids who just give up on themselves. I mean, it's just a huge, huge challenge. So when somebody can't or refuses to do it here, and the minimal options for them, that's been a huge challenge for us. And the emotional needs of the kids, our cities don't have the services to meet those tremendous emotional needs. Kids in the cities don't have places to go. Where if it were somebody in the suburbs, they'd be able to spend the money to take them to a counselor or to get them in a special program. And we don't have that in town. So kids just suffer horribly with no system able to mitigate that suffering, which is and which for me is an enormous problem, because I've seen kids. I described this in the 60 Minutes piece a little bit. I've seen kids who were dead, in effect, come back to life. Who were so flatlined, Joe, with depression, with anger. Their heart was so just gripped by this sadness that they could barely speak. And I watched them when they're cared for, when they begin to talk about it, when they begin to engage in this counseling process, I watch them come back to life. So this is not rocket science. And that's what makes me mad about it, because with the resources and with paying attention to just a few things, our cities could change. Our cities could change. People's attitudes in the cities could change. You have to provide job opportunities, obviously, for them. We're not, that's not what we do. We try to educate guys. But if we could address these kids' hearts as well as their heads, and I think that's been a big obstacle for us. And we do a great job of it, but we just need more of it. That's the problem.
Well said. And I'm hoping that resonates with a lot of our listeners out there who are trying to infuse some life into some of our schools in our inner cities and in some of our, even in the rural cities. I have one more question for you as we close out. And knowing what you know now, Father Ed, and you guys have had a lot of success. I mean, tremendous success, that you become this model for a lot of schools to learn from. But if you could go back and do things differently, if you could do some things differently, what advice would you give yourself and say, wow, now that I know better, now down the years, we've had a lot of success, but if I can go back and do some things this is what I would have done differently to have even accelerate that type of success that we were experiencing now, if that makes any sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I see if this helps. I would have paid attention to the kids' hearts sooner than we began to do it. That would be number one. I would have began this process of what we talk about now as accompaniment. That's all we're trying to do, so that accompanying kids through their teenage years, which for kids in general are very difficult, for kids in this city are very difficult and very dangerous. I would have begun that process sooner. And so paid and early on, we were looking at the intellect, right? The driving this agenda to the kids' intellects. I would have begun the process of tending to their heart earlier, I think, is what one of the things I would have done.
What have you seen to be the fallout of not doing that?
Number one, you lose kids. You lose kids in the street. You lose kids. Well, I mean, we've got guys. I've had to bury guys. So that's an extreme example of it. Or I get letters from guys that are incarcerated. It's the biggest thing we do in this country is incarcerate people, right? More than any other country in the world. We incarcerate people, and we incarcerate largely black and brown men. So that the odds are enormously high if you're a young man of color, you can wind up in jail, as opposed to for a number of reasons. Right? I mean, because number one, you don't get a decent defense. You get a public defender who's got a stack of files, goes to his ceiling, as opposed to somebody who can pay $750 an hour for an attorney that gets their kids off. So then you got that whole issue. But the issue of the heart is critical as far as I'm concerned, because it's a community. The community of color lives from its heart, not from its head. Lots of people who look like me have a tendency to live from their head, and so it becomes what are your grades? What is your grade point average? What are all those kinds of things? Well, if you're not tending to the heart, then it's very difficult to be the kind of man and father that I think that you focus on in the conversations that you have with people around the country.
And Father Leahy, I think that's a great, great, great point to end on in the show. And well, man, we've come to the end of our show, but don't you worry, we'll be back to do it all again next week with a new guest and new insights and new lessons. So make sure you don't miss it. And I'd like to thank Father Edwin Leahy for joining us today and taking time from his busy schedule, because I know he's busy at the school today. Father Ed, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Doctor, it's an honor.
And Father Ed, if quickly for us, for our listeners, if they wanted to find out more, we talked about the 60-minute interview, but if they want to find out more about what your school is doing, because I believe you're going to get a lot of people inquiring about, at least looking at you guys as a model, how could they find out more about your school and how could they get in contact with you?
Sure, you can get in contact with us on the website, www.sbpeter.org.
Okay. And we'll put that in the show notes for everyone to have access to that as well. And to all of you guys out there who are listening, please do us a favor. And this is so important. Take about 30 seconds to go over to iTunes and rate the program. It's the best way to help us get this program in the hands, ears, and hearts of men just like you. And please don't keep us a secret. Share us with your friends. Until next time, I'm Dr. Joe Martin, your man builder with realmenconnect.com, reminding you that we are males by birth, but we are men by choice. So each and every day, choose to be the man God called and created you to be, because a male is a terrible thing to waste. So until next time, stay strong, stay blessed, and as always, stay in his grip.
Thank you for listening to the Real Men Connect podcast with Dr. Joe Martin. Real Men Connect isn't just a podcast. It's a mission, ministry, and movement to help good men become the great men God called and created us to be. And the best is yet to come. So if you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and leave us a review in iTunes. It really helps us to build the podcast and to reach, teach, and impact more men, all for the glory of God. And make sure you check out realmenconnect.com to get our free tools and resources to help you go from good man to great man, God's way. Again, that's realmenconnect.com. Thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next episode.